In contrast, the Democrats' socialist program and platform, and it really is more than socialist, it's not just socialist, it's beyond socialism. He says communist. That's about right. But I recently announced my plan to deliver more opportunity, security, fairness, and prosperity to the Black community, to the Hispanic community. And you know what it is, I don't have to go over it, but it's the Platinum Plan, and it's gonna bring back new jobs, like at a level that you've never seen before, and we've done a lot, we've done a lot.
Hello, and welcome to the Reason Roundtable, the Platinum Plan of podcasts. That was President Donald J. Trump talking up his second term plans and talking down the Democratic agenda from a White House balcony this weekend in his first major in-person campaign event after falling ill with the coronavirus just over a week ago. I'm Peter Suderman, filling in for Matt Welch, who is out today learning to perfect his sourdough. And I am joined by my regular co-panelists, Catherine Mengu Ward and Nick Gillespie. Say hi, everybody.
Howdy.
Hey, Peter.
As well as special guest Eric Bain.
Hey guys, glad to be
here. Thanks for joining me, folks. Does anyone feel like we missed a Friday news dump last week? I mean, I wouldn't say we missed it, but this week was strangely calm for 2020. I actually want to start here just by doing a rundown of the three weekends prior to this most recent one. First, on Friday, September 18th, Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg died, starting a sure-to-be-bitter nomination battle less than 2 months before the presidential election. A week later, Trump nominated Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court. A week after that, and this was just two Fridays ago, Trump announced that he had caught COVID-19. He gets helicoptered off to Walter Reed, where he undergoes intensive treatment. At the same time, multiple other senior officials in the White House and prominent elected Republicans announce that they have it too. After just a few days in the hospital, Trump returns to the White House to recuperate, where he goes on the Twitter binge to end all Twitter binges, and then, as we just heard, announces plans to resume campaigning at in-person events. And the twist is, it looks very possible that Trump or others in the White House orbit caught the virus at the Coney Barrett nomination event. I guess that would be the second of these Friday weekend news dumps. Folks, the writers in our particular universe have been on an absolute roll this season. Big developments every single week. And they all get kind of tied up together, right? Like the plotting is really tight. And then this weekend kind of crickets. We did have a vice presidential debate last week, but even that was surprisingly taciturn, notable mostly for what the candidates didn't say, much more than what they did. It's telling, I think, that the biggest story to come out of the VP debate was that a fly landed on Mike Pence's head. There was a lot of buzz about that one, folks.
No.
And yet, none of this changes the fact that the policy stakes of this election are real and huge beneath all of the zany plot developments. We are not, in fact, watching an episode of 24 or Scandal, even though it sometimes feels like it. Healthcare, the federal budget, infrastructure, and energy are all going to be subjects of intense political and legislative wrangling over the next 4 years, no matter who wins this coming election. But since the debate was last week's big political event, I just want to start by asking everyone what they thought. Besides the fly, what was your biggest takeaway? What stood out to you? Catherine, let's go to you first.
So I actually was pretty pleased by that debate. I thought that it was nice that they talked about policy, which is always my dream and my hope. And it was so profoundly disappointed by the first and perhaps only presidential debate that I just want to say that. I know it's sort of obvious, but I still think it was great that they tried to talk about some real stuff. I was frankly most struck by Kamala Harris's first answer, which was such a non-answer. So much of this election is acting as if it is about the difference in the strategies for handling the coronavirus. And I was really struck that she used most of her 2 minutes to talk about how Trump had screwed up. And I think that is a relatively uncontroversial claim, though not entirely uncontroversial, and very little to talk about what either Biden would have done differently or what Biden will do when he wins, if he wins. And if we are mapping coronavirus response onto the two parties, which increasingly we are. There's some new polling data that I was just looking at this morning, which shows that people's opinions about the danger that they are facing from coronavirus are highly predicted by their partisan affiliations. I think that's a really, really bad thing. And I think it's weird that that debate opened with a total failure to differentiate what the coronavirus response would be between the two parties.
And Pence's response was, your plan is what we already did. You're not giving any details here, which is not exactly precisely perfectly true, but true enough in a lot of ways. Nick, what stood out to you?
To be honest, to kind of build on what Catherine was talking about, the lack of specifics and the lack of a kind of serious differentiation between the two candidates. Obviously, Joe Biden and Donald Trump are different people. I assume they will govern, you know, they would govern differently. But, you know, I keep coming back to kind of tallies of how much spending and debt either Trump or Biden will add to the treasury, you know, over the
spoilers. We are going to get to that.
You know, but the spoiler is that it's like the difference is much smaller than you would tend to think. And when you strip out rhetoric, we are on a kind of slow but fast moving or picking up speed boat to fiscal oblivion. And it, I think this election rightly is a referendum on Donald Trump's presidency. And that's one of the reasons why he's behind in the poll. And it's almost certain that Joe Biden is going to win because he has not governed very well on his own. The real problem for that, especially for those of us who don't identify as Republican or Democrat or feel good when our team is in the is in power, is that Biden is a terrible candidate, and he's a grab bag of pent-up demand of Democratic policies, you know, for probably really going on a decade when you consider how Obama was obstructed for a variety of reasons. And, you know, I walked away from the vice presidential debate really frustrated that not only are Donald Trump and Joe Biden the top picks, but then Kamala Harris and Mike Pence are the second tier people. I don't see this as a change election from a libertarian point of view.
Eric?
Yeah, I mean, I think two things struck me, one sort of short term and one long term. The short term one was just to build on what both Nick and Catherine have said, the lack of specifics that were offered. And in particular, and I actually wrote about this in particular, one question that was asked was, you know, under what circumstances or, you know, have you had the conversation is the way the question was asked. Have you had the conversation with the old guy on the top of your respective tickets about whether you would take over for them? Under what circumstances would you take over, either using the 25th Amendment or, you know, under what circumstances would the president pass power to the vice president? This is really the only question that matters, I think, in a vice presidential debate, because vice presidents have virtually no role whatsoever in policy making. In some cases, they might, you know, help, especially one who has a history in the Senate, like Joe Biden once did under Obama, and like Kamala Harris might have in the Biden administration, you know, might play a sort of go-between role. But really, the key question for vice presidents is, well, you know, what happens if the president is incapacitated in some way? And that's a very serious question, particularly now when you've got a president who is actively fighting a deadly disease, and you've got a wannabe president in Joe Biden, who is going to be the oldest man ever elected to the office if he is elected in November and inaugurated in January. And there have been some questions raised about his health conditions as well. And neither candidate, neither Pence nor Harris, even attempted to engage on that question at all. They both turned around and ran the other direction when that question was asked. And I think that's disappointing because
that was one of the themes of the night many ways, was
they
that
did this
both of
question.
Them just absolutely refused to directly answer the questions that were posed to them. And it was at every point they did the old, communication strategist trick of answering the topic rather than answering the question. And then you didn't get a lot of information out of them because of that.
I mean, Harris, on this question about Biden's health issues and would you be comfortable taking over the role of the presidency if he was incapacitated, she chose instead to just spin some like stump speech yarn about her own biography and how proud her mother would be that she was here on the debate stage. I mean, she didn't even address the topic. She just talked about a whole different thing.
I want the candidate who will say, you know, my parents, thankfully they're dead because they would be humiliated and outraged that right. I was about to become the vice president.
There was really a sense, though, with both of those candidates that it was like asking a magic eight ball, except instead of, you know, looks
yeah,
great.
It's like a Turing test. You know, well,
time
for
will
politicians.
Tell, right?
It's
well,
like
it was, you, every answer was ask again later.
Right. It was ask again later. But it was, I mean, it was like you just sort of, they spun the wheel and picked a random monologue that they had memorized, you know, to respond.
But that was still better than the first debate, right? I mean, I actually think it is better. Like, I know, Nick, you're over there with your ing, but like, I think that the basic formalisms of political debate are good and they were like mostly observed. And it's true that some of those formalisms are observed in the breach, right? Oh, I'm just going to answer the previous question real quick is a tried and true technique of all debaters. But I didn't realize how much I valued that format and just the like absolute minimal level of respect that it conveyed for the other party as well as for the moderator until, you know, you don't know what you got till it's gone, baby.
I think that was like the main long term takeaway for me was that there's maybe a chance that politics gets back to some semblance of normal when and if Donald Trump is removed from the stage. And I know Nick is going to jump in and he's absolutely right to say that the normal is bad and we shouldn't wish to go back to the normal. And he's exactly right about that. The normal is bad in many ways. The new normal is also bad. And I don't know which of those things is worse. It felt like a debate from 2012 or 2004.
I was going to say, though, that the debate format is actually like, you know, is just a failure. I mean, if the best that you can say is that this was a more polite and respectful debate. And I agree with Catherine that can be underestimated, the value of people just not treating each other like pieces of garbage in public. You know, there's actually a serious value to that. But why are we putting up with this kind of discourse? We have like absolute freedom in terms of media creation and things like that. And we're stuck with these debate formats that are terrible and are actually even worse than in the past, because the single moderator, if the moderator is not going to kind of insist on answers and like cut people off and just be like, you know what, you're not answering the question, let's go to something else. You know, it's just useless. I mean, it was 90 minutes or whatever that none of us will ever get back and none of us will ever, you know, revisit in any serious way.
I think having the two candidates, I think having the two candidates
debate commission
model the behavior of knowing that you are going to disagree with someone, but sitting there for a hot minute and letting them say their piece and then saying your piece and then, if not smiling at each other, at least grimacing at each other. Like, that's a thing that we are getting worse and worse at. And I don't think it's a bad idea to have an hour and a half of TV every now and then where the most powerful humans in our country show that behavior.
Yeah, civilized disagreement where the other side is not evil simply for being the other side is nice. Also, for future debates, we should release more like bugs and things into the debate stage. Maybe like start with a few at the beginning and every 15 minutes, like there's a larger volume of them.
My dream is that you get Joe Rogan to moderate, but it's actually a Fear Factor episode. I think, you know,
what about
dunking somebody in a box
slime?
Of cobras, you know, and asking them fiscal policy questions, we'd get better answers than we're getting now.
If you want like an extra 2 minutes to make your point, you have to do it like while your hand is in a box of scorpions, something like that, right?
I want the green slime from You Can't Do That on Television. That's a deep cut, but
a bag of cats and iguanas, which was one of the distraction tools that Will Smith and Martin Lawrence used at the end of Bad Boys 2 to invade the drug lord's mansion. I thought Jacob Sullum put it pretty nicely in his piece, just the title and subhead. The Pence-Harris debate was a model of civility, evasion, and obfuscation. Politeness is nice. Answering questions would be even nicer. The thing that stuck out to me was the odd normalcy of it, the kind of the boring calmness, especially in contrast with the presidential debate the week before. And in some ways, it gave me a little bit of hope that things will return to a less exhausting, less exasperated pre-Trump normal. And on the other hand, maybe the fact that we're going to return to a pre-Trump normal is a bummer and is kind of terrible. And also, maybe that tells us something that's actually a little bit useful, which is that Trump might not be the disruptor that many of the people who supported him or were at least interested in his candidacy had hoped for, that the disruptions of the Trump era aren't going to last. Or perhaps he might be a disruptor of a different kind. So let's talk about that. In specific, let's talk about what Democrats would do. I think we should actually drill down into this a little more than Kamala Harris did. Let's look at the Democratic agenda for the next 4 years and whether it would, in fact, constitute a return to normalcy. So last week, the folks at Vox.com published a piece titled "What a Democratic Senate Wants." The subtitle was "Democrats could take back the Senate in 2020. They have a massive to-do list." A massive to-do list. So the piece takes readers through a slew of issues and policy ideas, from climate change to an infrastructure plan, which might even be the same thing. But it all kind of starts with the expectation that a Democratic Senate would do a massive COVID relief bill along the lines of the $3.3 trillion HEROES Act that has been floating around in the House for most of the summer. But that bill could end up being a vehicle for a laundry list of additional policies, including things like healthcare. At one point, the article suggests that a COVID relief bill could, in fact, be expanded to include Joe Biden's entire healthcare plan, which would set up a government-run health insurance plan that would cost about $750 billion over 10 years, according to the Biden campaign, and possibly a lot more, according to some other estimates. The whole thing kind of reminds me of James Cameron's Avatar sequels, none of which have come out yet. But like every
we're
time
already
you
feeling
check
bad
the news,
enough.
Go in.
Seems like he's always working on another one. It started as Avatar 2 and 3, and then it was Avatar 2, 3, and 4, and now it's literally Avatar 2, 3, 4, and 5, and I keep expecting just like Avatar 2 through 27 to hit the movie schedule, and there's like a Dark Smurfs spinoff going to be associated with this. It just keeps getting bigger and more elaborate all the time. And of course, it also keeps not happening. So Nick, I want to start with you here. On a scale of Pet Shop Boys reunion tour to James Cameron's Avatar number 14, how excited are you for Democrats to retake the Senate?
I'm not, and this is the strongest argument for a Trump second term, I think, is that he would stand in the way of a Democratic Senate steamrolling through something similar. I think what we would be looking at is a replay of the first 2 years of the Obama administration, where he got everything he wanted. And that was not a good outcome for the country. Ultimately, was not a good outcome for the Democratic Party either, as they got voted out in the midterms. But Biden himself has committed, you know, roughly, according to various kind of estimates, somewhere about spending an extra $11 trillion over the next 10 years in his budget plans. If Kamala Harris takes office, she, as you pointed out, I believe last week, Peter, has committed to something like $45 trillion in new spending. I mean, and these are in new spending terms. So this is on top of they're going to be inheriting a federal budget that's probably $6 trillion. This is, to me, is one of the biggest problems about the calming kind of payoff of a return to normalcy is not a good thing, because it's not normal. We have gone through a period in the past couple of years, and particularly in the past 6 months, where every aspect of government control over every aspect of our behavior and the Fed and in terms of spending has ratcheted up incredibly. And there's no indications that any of that is coming down. So I look at, you know, the first 6 months of a Biden administration is a free-for-all where it's going to be with a Democratic Senate, and they're going to be able to push through everything that they want. And that means, you know, a $2 trillion Green New Deal. It means, version at least of Joe Biden. It means a Medicare for all public option. It means massive spending on the economy, supposedly on the economy. It will be a very bad period because it will normalize, or it will lock into place, a massively higher level of government control over every aspect of our lives.
Eric, and it is useful, as always, to compare and contrast on these things between the parties. And the folks at the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget have looked at the fiscal effects of both Biden's agenda and, to the extent that you could call it that, Trump's plans, and they report that they're actually much closer than one might think. I'm just going to read a little bit from the introduction of their report. Under their main estimate, they find that President Donald Trump's campaign plan would increase the debt by $4.95 trillion over 10 years, and former Vice President Biden's plan would increase the debt by $5.6 trillion. Debt would rise from 98% of gross domestic product today to 125% in 2030 under President Trump and 128% under President Biden compared to 109% under current law. Now, this comes with some exceptions. It excludes COVID relief. It makes a bunch of assumptions about how various policies enacted. It is looking at the presidential agendas rather than the Senate agendas. But still, doesn't this tell us something important? Or useful anyway, about how close Trump and Biden are, and perhaps how similar Democrats and Republicans really are on some of these big picture fiscal issues.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think, first of all, you can't completely rule out the idea that God unleashed the coronavirus on the planet just to stop James Cameron's 20 Avatar sequels from ever
getting
to theaters.
Thank you, God.
Killing
They're
movie
filming
theaters.
Again.
Like, it's possible.
He has shown photos of, like, the crab boat that's going to be in, you know, Avatar
it's
17.
It's very possible movie theaters have been killed just to keep those movies from ever being released. On the other hand, yeah, I think you're right. I think there's not a huge, obviously, we're talking about trillions of dollars here, so there is a huge gap between, say, $4 trillion and $10 trillion. That's a massive amount of money. But yes, both President Donald Trump, given his 4 years of track record and what he's proposed to do if he gets another term, and Vice President Joe Biden, if he's elected, are both going to spend more money. They're both going to increase the national debt, put more money on the deficit, all of that. If you want fiscal responsibility, you're not going to find it in either of the two major party candidates running for president this year. I think just to sort of flip one thing that Nick said, I think the best check on runaway government spending, not that there really is a good one, but the best of a lot of bad options at the moment would be for Republicans to hold the Senate, because I think they do have, Mitch McConnell has that sort of playbook that he'll just dust off again from the Obama years. And there is a, at least, smallish constituency amongst Senate Republicans who do care about the debt and deficit issues and certainly would again prioritize those things, I think, during a Biden administration. So there's that. But the other issue here and the other sort of complicating factor is that it's just so difficult to know what Trump wants to do, because even that has changed almost on a daily basis in the past week. We began last week with President Trump calling off negotiations with the House. He's had his Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin kind of running point for the White House on the negotiations over this next coronavirus relief bill. He called the dogs off on Monday or Tuesday of last week. And then by the end of the week, by Friday, he was on Twitter almost begging Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi to agree to an even larger spending figure. So that's the real difficulty here. Yes, we can put numbers on some of these proposals. There are always caveats there. And then the one big caveat, especially with Trump, is that you just really don't know what it is that he wants to do, because he doesn't have a firm grasp of policy and never has.
Yeah, he doesn't know what he wants to do, which makes it difficult for us to figure out what he wants to do. And he turns over negotiations for things like this to trusted lieutenants who then get to make the deals themselves. But they do so in many cases without good connections on Capitol Hill. Steve Mnuchin is not somebody who is deeply embedded in the world of Republican politics historically. And so what ends up happening is that Mnuchin might negotiate something with Nancy Pelosi, and then and Trump says, sure, that's great, that sounds wonderful, and then Republicans on the Hill are like, no, I'm not sure I'm going to do that, or maybe they go along. I want to actually go back to the Democrats just a little
bit.
Do
you guys seriously think that the economy and that the level of regulation, and especially, again, if you take Joe Biden at his word and read his proposals on his campaign platform, He is talking just, you know, for instance, in talking about doing everything possible to make it easier or make it criminal for employers to do all sorts of things and to expand union rights in the workplace, make it easier for everybody to organize, including independent contractors. He's going to have the federal government make sure that corporations are doing this, this, and this in ways that are, you know, consistent with whatever his constituency wants. Do you guys really think that the economy will be in a better place if Biden is in power and Biden has more or less free run? I mean, there's a policy nihilism here, which strikes me as, you know, as you know, we can say there's not a lot of difference between Republicans and Democrats, but I find it hard to believe that you seriously think a Biden-run economy or an economy with Biden in the White House is going to be better.
No, you were right the first time. No, I mean, I think this is an important distinction that that a lot of people miss and that I think Reason historically has done a good job of noting, which is there is the size of government. And that means two different things. It means how expensive government is. And it also means how intrusive government is. And I think it's pretty clear that in the last 4 years, Republicans have decided they don't really mind if government is very expensive. They also don't really mind if government is very intrusive in certain areas. So, for instance, trade, which, like, I'm not about to trade-splain with Eric Boehm on the pod, but, like, you know, the economic nationalism of the Trump administration, which has manifested largely in our trade policy, I think is very clear. And that is an example where the interference and scope of government has grown. But I think Nick is right that there, you know, and Peter started us out here, that there is some real pent-up regulatory fervor out there. Like, there are a lot of people who have been writing white papers for 4 years in preparation for the day when Democrats can do stuff again. And, I think as much as Trump has in many ways utterly failed in his promises to deregulate the economy, he has, through inaction, succeeded in at least stemming the rate of growth of regulation. And I think, you know, speaking of you don't know what you got till it's gone, if we wind up with Biden in power, if we wind up with Biden in power with a Democratic Congress, we are going to see just like a wild amount of labor regulation, environmental regulation, housing regulation, like even stuff that is not right now the business of the federal government will become a bit more the business of the federal government in ways that we are currently not probably fully equipped to appreciate. So I think, but I do think at the same time, people who would point to Trump's record of not doing a lot of new regulations in those areas and ignore the absolutely insane growth in federal spending and also the absolutely insane amount of interference in other parts of the economy, you know, it would be wrong to call him a deregulator, full stop.
Eric, do you want to do some trade-splaining for us? Again, I think the comparing and contrasting here is valuable. In terms of how Trump has conducted America's trade policy, how would you rate it, describe it? But also, what would you expect from trade policy in a Biden administration where Democrats have 51 seats in the Senate?
Yeah, that's interesting because Biden has, I mean, to start off, Trump has in some ways done things that the Democrats have wanted to do on trade for a long time, right? Like Democrats have for the last 20 to 30 years at least been the party that's been more in favor of protectionism, that has talked about tariffs. Now, I mean, the big exception to that is that actually George W. Bush, a Republican, temporarily put some tariffs on during his administration. So both parties have run afoul of misunderstanding how trade works. It's not all one-way traffic here. But in many ways, the things that Trump has done, particularly against China, are things that that you would typically expect from a Democrat. And there's often been, and I've written about this, we've talked about this on the podcast, kind of the convergence of the Bernie Sanders leftist view on trade and the Donald Trump far-right nationalist view on trade. They're actually not that far apart. Now, the interesting thing on the other side with Joe Biden is that he's a guy who throughout much of his career has been more of a pro-trader, even though he's a Democrat, even though he's, you know, in a party that is typically somewhat more hostile to free trade. And so I think, you know, he's been moved to the left a bit during the primary process. He's embraced and he's been, you know, he, I won't say he's embraced, but he's been very careful not to say that he will remove Trump's tariffs as soon as he gets into office. It seems like he wants to keep them in place, at least as leverage or something to negotiate with China. You know, hey, we'll remove the tariffs if you do X, Y, and Z. If you believe that free trade makes humanity more prosperous, makes America more prosperous, then you don't really have any good options with these two candidates. And I do believe that. And I think the facts and history bear that out. Neither of them are going to operate as if they are believers in just free trade, full stop. But I do think that the Biden administration will at least have some sort of a goal-oriented series of policies that the Trump administration has kind of lacked. And so at least in that regard, there's a way to critique it. There's at least a way to critique it or to maybe nudge it in a certain way when it's not just sort of a religious belief that tariffs will make America great again or something.
Well, I mean, to be fair to Trump, he is goal-oriented. The goal is to show China what for.
Yeah, sure.
To be strong and specifically to be strong vis-a-vis China. I mean, I actually do think we're going to get this situation where, weirdly, Republicans have paved the way for Democrats to be allowed to do some stuff on trade they would have liked to do for a long time but couldn't do politically, which is very frustrating, to say the least. But that, you know, if Biden comes in with a status quo that's so much more not only kind of baseline hostile to trade or to trade with certain parties, but also disordered, right? Like he's coming into a situation where norms have been violated. And so, he's going to have an opportunity to kind of remake stuff and reset stuff in places that are probably going to be more protectionist than, for instance, you know, Hillary Clinton would have come in with as her baseline.
It's sort of the inverse of the Democrats removed the judicial filibuster and then Republicans made them pay for it.
Right.
You could certainly see that sort of thing playing out in the executive branch in the next 4 years.
It might just be rhetorical, but again, if you go to Biden's campaign promises, he spends a huge amount of time talking about buying American, instituting pretty rigid quota systems for buying American for all federal contractors, for increasing R&D to grow the domestic auto industry, for instance. He loves talking about how he saved the auto industry, just like he cured cancer and, you know, didn't touch anybody's kids or something. He is going deep on that, and that will play into, you know, we are going through a spasm of nationalism and isolationism because of COVID. When you direct that particularly at the Chinese, this is just something. And when you see, one of the real questions, and this to me is the real wild card of a Biden victory. I assume a Biden victory means a Democratic Senate as well, which, you know, may or may not happen. But does the Democratic Party...
sense is that Biden is more likely to win the presidency than Democrats are to win the Senate, though, of course, if Biden wins the presidency, that probably makes it more likely that Democrats will
take
the Senate.
And, then what happens is how far to the left has he been pulled or how powerless is he against that? What happens to kind of centrist Democrats? Do they start looking across the aisle to formerly libertarianish Republicans in Congress or something? I mean, a lot of things can happen that are weird, but I think the clearest, you know, implication of a Biden win is that he has a clear shot for 2 years of instituting everything that he and Democrats have been talking on that gets built on top of what Trump has been talking on. And you get not just the growth of government, but an increase in the scope of government regulating all aspects of the economy, and that is really not a good thing.
Catherine, speaking of goals, which I think requires a hashtag
goals. Hashtag goals,
Nick,
squad goals.
Nick mentioned a couple of minutes ago Obama's first term and how Obama came out of the gate swinging with what was at the time the history's biggest stimulus bill, right? Just under $1 trillion, right? And
and the good old days.
You know, and then a healthcare bill and Dodd-Frank and all of this. But one difference between Obama's first term and what would be Joe Biden's is that Obama had 60 Democrats in the Senate and Biden pretty much certainly will not. So, hanging over all of this is the filibuster, which basically says that you need 60 votes in the Senate to do anything unless you want to do stuff through a process called reconciliation, which puts a bunch of restrictions on what you can and can't pass, namely that they must be germane to the budget and score as deficit neutral outside the 10-year time horizon that the Congressional Budget Office works on. Incidentally, that's how both the Bush tax cuts and the Trump tax cuts were passed, which is why both had a bunch of provisions that expire inside of a decade. So, Catherine, the short version seems to be that Democrats are pretty clearly signaling that they will kill the filibuster if Republicans don't just agree to let Democrats do whatever it is they want. Is that fine? Is that okay? I mean, as long as we're sort of, I mean, in some ways, I want to contextualize this with the Coney Barrett hearing, where Republicans are saying the rules allow us to do this. We are going to do this. That's pretty much what Democrats are saying, too. The rules would allow them to do that. They can change the rules at any time. How do you feel about the sort of the normative process aspect of this and the fact that the normative process aspect is going to play perhaps an outsized role in the debate about how the next Congress, if it is controlled by Democrats, goes about policymaking?
Yeah, on a personal level, I am sick to death of the posturing around the filibuster. And so part of me is like, fine, burn it to the ground. Let's just be done. You know, when I was a wee little cub reporter at the Weekly Standard, I covered a bunch of fuss and bother about some judicial confirmations, which there wasn't even a real filibuster. There was sort of a Potemkin filibuster, a quasi-filibuster, which was like an all-nighter to highlight that the filibuster existed so that maybe we could think about whether or not the nomination process was broken. And at that point, way back in the dark ages, there was still a teeny bit of shame left. There was still like a teeny bit of a desire to not be seen as just fully hypocritical. And so there was some on this matter specifically, to be clear, like hypocrisy was rampant and shameless. But specifically on the filibuster, specifically with regard to judicial nominations, there was a moment when people were attempting to tell consistent stories about their party's positions with respect to the filibuster. I think that moment is past. And now it is purely, you know, Lindsey Graham is the spirit animal of this. You know, you hold me to account. I will not misbehave. I will not make an appointment under X, Y, and Z conditions. And you play this tape. Yeah, JK, I don't care about your tape. We're going to do it. That's where we are now. So in some ways, it's like, just get rid of the filibuster and call it a day. I do think, I mean, we are now having, among all of the many other national debates we are now having, yet again, we are revisiting some Nancy McLean territory and having a national debate about how much democracy is too much democracy. And Senator Mike Lee is out here tweeting that maybe too much democracy is too much. And I actually think that is a really important conversation to have, but I don't have any idea how to resolve it. The filibuster is part of that. The filibuster is essentially a check on majoritarian impulses. And in general, I am in favor of checks on majoritarian impulses, but I don't know how this one is functioning at this point other than as a sort of process-breaking bottleneck. So maybe it's time for it to go.
I think, if you take Trump not simply as the cause of a breakdown in norms that, among other things, have caused the Democrats to openly talk about how they're going to get rid of the filibuster and the Electoral College and things like that.
And pack the court.
And if instead you recognize that Trump is he's the effect of a breakdown in norms that has been going on for, at least 20 years, I would say, just to keep it in the 21st century, I think there's every reason to believe that the filibuster will either in fact or in practice be gone if the Democrats win a majority, if they win the White House and a majority in the Senate and the House, and they need to work around it in order to pass a legislative agenda, which is going to be big and bold. There's no, we need to take people at face value, you know, and this is what they're talking about. I don't think there's any reason to think that it won't happen. It, you know, or that, and this is the other thing, is that the descent into madness, and by that I don't necessarily mean insanity, but rage and anger and, you know, spittle-flecked communication for the past 4 years or the past 8 years or the past 20 years, like, that's not going to go away, regardless of who wins. So I think you can kiss the filibuster goodbye.
I mean, in terms of the boldness, one of the things that struck me about the Vox piece on the Senate Democrats' agenda, almost independent of the specific policy issues that were raised, was just how determined Democrats in the Senate seem to be to eat the full buffet, right? They view this as a moment to fundamentally reshape the federal government along liberal policy lines. Like, this is, they want the whole enchilada here. I've got a couple of quotes. I want to point out
that if you're at a buffet and you're eating the enchiladas, you're doing it wrong. You know, go for the shrimp and steak at the beginning.
If you're at a buffet right now, full stop, you've made a mistake.
We have gone full buffet.
2020 is not the year of the buffet, you guys.
Oh.
So here is Senator Brian Schatz of Hawaii. The idea that we're going to have to prioritize essentially one topic at a time is preposterous.
Yeah. Preposterous.
The idea that we're going to look at COVID, healthcare, the economy, climate, and say, okay, which one of these do we pick? It's a waste of a win. Debbie Stabe now of Michigan. Oh my gosh, there's so much. We feel a great sense of responsibility and a great sense of urgency. So, Nick, some ways, I want to ask you the same question as Catherine. Does this strike you as a power grab or a breaking of norms in some way? Or are they just giving their voters what they want?
Yeah, I think those two things are not mutually opposed. And I think a better way of looking at this is, you know, less in terms of kind of partisan terms and like, oh, the Republicans, you know, they gave it their best shot of holding back government growth. And, you know, and then finally they're, you know, their tiny little hands were weakened by grass, you know, holding on so tight for so long, and they gave way to this, you know, because Peter, as you have written about and we talk about on a weekly basis, under the Republicans and under Donald Trump, spending massively increased. There's like the growth of government does not care if it's a Republican or a Democrat in the White House. What changes is that there are moments where certain things get solidified and they become the new norm. And this is the exact moment that we're going through. When he shuts the limited government door, he opens the Overton window to a massively new, permanently expanded, heightened scope of government and spending. And we are going from, you know, in 2000, Matt and Welch and I always used to talk about this and write about this, you know, it was Clinton's final budget was like around $2 trillion, you know, and then it was like 8 years later, it was like, $4 trillion. Now it's $6
trillion. $2 trillion is what we spent in like the third week of April.
And it's like, what is happening now, regardless, and absent a truly ideological challenge as well as a political one, is that we are going to be locked into federal budgets that are going to be around $6 trillion easy. Absolutely nothing has been done about entitlement reform or entitlement spending or even giving a shit about any of that. The regulatory state, and this is something where I think Trump, you know, from a libertarian perspective, disappointing, from a kind of less jaundiced view, not so bad in terms of regulating all aspects of the economy. That is the big problem. I feel like we have gone through the spending phase where things are ratcheted up higher and higher. And now it's kind of like at the end of the Great Society, LBJ hits the skids, but that level of funding gets locked in. And then Nixon comes along, you know, the great enemy, the great, you know, anti-communist, blah, 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 who then creates the regulatory completion of the Great Society. That's what I feel like is happening here, where every, you know, the Leviathan is locking in its gains. We're screwed on that, Cam.
Peter, I wonder how much of this, and I'm just curious for your take on this, because you were in D.C. during the Obamacare debates.
Wow, that's like a Matt Welch question.
You live in Washington, D.C.
Vaguely insulting D.C. somehow.
You lived through that. And so I wonder how, and the aftermath of that, more importantly, and how much of, do you think Democrats are being inspired, let's say, to put all of these ideas, maybe, it'll just be like the coronavirus relief bill of 2021, and it'll also include the Green Green New Deal and socialized Medicare and everything they want all in one bill. Because, I mean, they saw after Obamacare passed, it was a major accomplishment. And yet it felt like it went from, you know, this is a big fucking deal, as Joe Biden said, to immediately it just took the legs out from under their, you know, any attempt at holding the Senate. It completely destroyed the majorities that they had in some state legislatures at the time, too. So, like, how much of this is like, well, we're going to get one shot to do one thing, and so that one thing might as well be all the things. Is that what's motivating them?
That's a lot of it. So there are a bunch of different types of ripple effects that are coming out of Obamacare and the Obamacare wars, that not just the passage in, you know, the effort to pass it in 2009 and then eventually it passed in March of 2010, but all of the kind of fights that we have had over it since and the changing politics where Democrats are now running on Obamacare as a popular accomplishment and arguably won control of the House in 2018. This is not just me saying this. This is senior Republicans have said this in off the record private meetings that have been leaked, that they believe that Democrats' best argument in the 2018 midterm was Obamacare. That is the argument that they are making today about the Supreme Court nominee, Amy Coney Barrett, that she would be a threat to Obamacare. And so they view that as, in some ways, a missed opportunity. They wanted, a bunch of them wanted to do a public option back then. A bunch of them wanted it to be much bigger. And they think that this is now, why were we so timid? Why did we miss that opportunity and not take that chance that we had to do everything we wanted? And especially since in the years since, all we've gotten is resistance from Republicans who have just not done anything on their own. What we should do is no longer consider the Republicans to be good faith working partners. And that was in some ways why we got Obamacare in the form that we got it, was that it was based on Romney Care. And in fact, a bunch of Republicans had said, not a majority necessarily, but a bunch of prominent Republicans basically supported a plan like that in the decade or so leading up to the passage of Obamacare. And then they flipped immediately as soon as Democrats wanted to do it. And that one of the reasons it took so long was because they were trying to get Republican votes and were trying to get a bipartisan.
Remember, though, the mood of the country. I mean, Obamacare, Obama spent a lot of time and what remained ultimately of his political capital trying to convince the last couple of Democratic senators he needed in order to pass it.
And that is the absolutely
unpopular piece of legislation, which is also now the law of the land, though. And even when you hollow out, like get rid of the, you know, the tax fines and all of that kind of stuff, we're stuck with Obamacare, right? You know, essentially.
Yes, we very much are currently stuck with Obamacare. It has been the law of the land for a little more than 10 years now. And I suspect that regardless of how the Supreme Court goes, it's going to continue to be. But that's the other thing, Eric, to answer your question, is that on the one hand, they feel like it was a missed opportunity to do a lot more, but they are forgetting how difficult it was to do even what they did and how damaging it was for their short-term political fortunes. Now, again, that has turned around in the last couple of years, but they are forgetting that it was a huge struggle that took them over a year to get passed, that came perilously close to not passing at all, that even like top Obama political strategists were saying, let's just forget this and do something else. It was Nancy Pelosi who at the end said, look, I can cobble together the votes to vote on this kind of messy Senate version that we now are stuck with because of the loss of one seat in the Senate. And so I do think they are forgetting that Democrats lost the House in 2010 because of Obamacare. And I think there is a real chance of a similar backlash.
But if you're going to be politically punished in the short term, but ultimately rewarded in the long term, as you said, Peter, they're now running on how popular Obamacare is. If you're going to be punished in the short term anyway and rewarded in the long term anyway, I guess you might as well go big. And that's why the ratchet only goes in one direction. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Also, when they lost the House in 2010, what happened was that all of the more centrist moderate Democrats were the ones who lost their seats. And so Obamacare cost them in the short term, but reshaped the Democratic Party and made it more liberal, which is why they now have this gigantic to-do list that we've been talking about. So let's move on from the economy and the Democratic agenda just a little bit before we finish up here. I want to talk about the Coney Barrett hearings. In some ways, this is a huge moment for the court and for the country, for public perception about the court. These hearings could have, you know, at least a giant public profile. if not a huge impact, because in another way, they are essentially meaningless. Republicans have the votes. Unless some GOP senators get sick or otherwise become unavailable, which I suppose is at least a possossibility, this is pretty much a done deal. And so
I'm laughing these, like, at the idea that somewhere, right, like Democratic, like, operatives are spreading virus monkeys in the hometowns of various senators.
The Democratic operatives don't have to do it. The Republicans are doing it themselves.
Yeah. They're sending out fake emails like Donald Trump Jr. wants you to come to a coffee clatch, you know.
So the arguments, as I see them so far today, are basically the Democrats are saying you guys are hypocrites. And Amy Coney Barrett would be bad for Obamacare. Republicans' argument in favor of her is, we're not hypocrites, but it wouldn't matter if we were. And she would be a good qualified justice. Also, she's got a lot of kids. So before we
finish up, I just want to go around the group. When I read the Democratic emails about this, you know, it's like she bought them.
Nick,
and it's not even clear she has the mortgage on them.
Shouldn't you be in favor of that? I just want to go around the group here. What do you guys expect from the hearings? What should we expect? What are hearings like this good for? When the conclusion is essentially not in doubt. Eric, let's start with you.
I don't expect to learn a whole lot. Although I guess there could be some huge bombshells like there were, or potential, maybe, I don't know, call them fake bombshells like there were during the Kavanaugh hearings. Honestly, I don't expect to learn a whole lot. I expect that she will be confirmed pretty much along party lines. I think in some ways this is maybe actually going to be a bit of an anticlimax, because I really don't see. It's not like anybody's mind is going to be changed here. I don't really expect much.
Nick, what are you looking for besides the details of her child mortgage?
Yeah, you know, I want to know how many more options she has on villages in Haiti, you know. I look forward to her being on the Supreme Court. And, you know, I talked with Jacob Sullum about this for a video that's somewhere on the Reason.com page, but that Amy Coney Barrett is actually good from a libertarian perspective. She will be a good addition to the court, both on Fourth Amendment issues as well as on a wide variety of government regulatory issues. And the most interesting thing about her, because this all comes down to abortion, or virtually all of it comes down to abortion, she's on the record, it's mixed, but she's on the record saying that the core finding in Roe v. Wade, that there is a period in which a woman, the government has no right to reach into a woman's uterus, that's not going anywhere. And I think that that's largely the case. And if progressives were able to kind of step back a little bit from their reactions or reflexes on this, they would be more comfortable with Amy Coney Barrett.
Catherine?
I am going to be really interested to see how much direct airing the question of her faith gets. Joe Biden was on a tarmac today or yesterday saying, no, her faith should not be considered during the hearings, which I think is interesting. I feel like there's been a lot of casual fear-mongering around the idea that she is in a Catholic cult. And in general, there, I think, have been some kind of remaining barriers on how directly and aggressively someone's religious affiliations are questioned by members of Congress. And I think we might see those last barriers fall. I would be sorry to see them go. It sounds like Joe Biden even would be sorry to see them go. He obviously has some personal connection to this issue. But I think that that is going to be the place where the grandstanding goes too far. We are used to hearings where senators are just big douchebags who say whatever they want to say for a really, really long time. But I am watching to see if we have a sort of bonus level to the douchebaggery. And I think that is where it will be.
A bonus level to the douchebaggery.
All right.
She is going to be. Everyone can look forward to.
I suspect that she will be a bigger immediate disappointment to conservatives, like right-wing conservatives,
than
Roberts, but although she's from Indiana, so maybe it's in the water there, but Gorsuch, who people have got, what, he doesn't really hate gays? What's going on here? I think she's going to be a better justice than a lot of people are understanding.
I I get that it's cold comfort to Democrats, who, especially those who are very, very focused on the abortion issue. But like, truly, Supreme Court justices do not do what people think they are going to do. And if there is anything that has demonstrated that, it's already the Trump appointees have demonstrated that repeatedly. You know, there is it. I know that we are sort of short-term focused right now. And so the question of, will she be in place to decide the most recent Obamacare case? And also, will she be in place to decide an election in toss-up, and who will she be loyal to in those cases? Those are legitimate questions, but I also think, like, Supreme Court justices answer to no man and perhaps no God.
You know, one of the other interesting things about her, conceivably too, is, you know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, from a libertarian perspective, was pretty bad overall, like her jurisprudence. She was good on a bunch of criminal justice issues and certain free speech issues, but not Citizens United. She's terrible on, you know, race and Obamacare and like an expanded reading of the Commerce Clause. But her life was really, you know, a something worth considering, particularly like for the full participation of women. And feminism kind of becoming a background feature of American life in a way, I think, that benefits everybody. I think Barrett may have a similar, you know, could have a similar function, because she is, you know, she apparently has, you know, this traditionalist religious subculture within Catholicism that she's really into. She is also, like, it cracks me up when left-wingers are like, you know, she is obedient to her husband. And it's like, God, if there is anybody who is like a Dennis Thatcher, it's Mr. Barrett, right? You know, it's like, who gives a shit about him? And I think she presents a different model of kind of, you know, female empowerment or something, or equality and participation in everything. And, you know, in that sense, I think, you know, I think it's good. I think she's something different that we haven't seen before. She's not Phyllis Schlafly. She's like, you know, something far beyond
Speaking
that.
Of the ways.
I think it's always wrong for libertarians to hope for anything in politics, but I think there's good reason to hope that she's probably more like a Gorsuch than a Kavanaugh. She probably, you know, she's somewhere, I think, in that spectrum. But I think there's probably good reason to think that she's closer to Gorsuch. So, yeah, positive development on the court if she gets there, which she will.
I do think that she is likely to disappoint conservatives who are expecting her to be a vote against Obamacare here. That is, and maybe even disappoint liberals who are running on this as well. I mean, you've got Chuck Schumer out there tweeting this morning that a vote for any senator for Judge Amy Coney Barrett is a vote to rip away healthcare for millions and end protections for Americans with pre-existing conditions in the middle of the COVID pandemic. But if you actually just look at the arguments in the case that is about to go before the Supreme Court, they're quite weak. And there's no reason to think that Coney Barrett, or perhaps even many of the other Republican appointed justices, would buy it. It's unlike the previous two major Supreme Court challenges to Obamacare, which I thought were quite strong on the legal merits. This one is quite weak. And I suspect that Coney Barrett, I mean, you never know, but I suspect that Coney Barrett will end up siding against the states that are challenging Obamacare here. So that is it for our main discussion this week. Let's go on to whatcha watching, Eric. Let's start with you. What have you been consuming this week?
I've been consuming a lot of the Major League Baseball playoffs, and give me a minute to make the case here. In particular, I watched a terrific game on Friday night between the Tampa Bay Rays and the New York Yankees that was decided when Mike Broussard, an undrafted player — there are 100 rounds in the baseball draft — not a single team decided, yes, let's draft Mike Broussard years ago when he came out of school. He's made his way.
He's that good.
He's made his way to the major leagues. He entered a winner-take-all game for the Tampa Rays against the New York Yankees on Friday night. He came up to bat in the eighth inning of a 1-1 game to face one of the most expensive relief pitchers in baseball history, Aroldis Chapman of the Yankees. Let's go back. Back in August, these two guys faced each other. Chapman hit Broussard in the head with a pitch, part of a sort of back and forth of both teams hitting players on the other team. Bit of a fight broke out. There's that backstory. Broussard comes to the plate, eighth inning of this decisive game against the big bad New York Yankees. He's quickly behind, no balls and two strikes, and then he just starts fouling pitches off. He fouls off the third pitch. He fouls off the fourth pitch. He's fouling off 100-mile-an-hour fastballs and 80-mile-an-hour sliders that are breaking down and out of the zone. He's battling one of the best relief pitchers in baseball. And finally, on the 10th pitch of the at-bat, Mike Broussard hits a 101-mile-an-hour fastball out of the stadium for a home run, turned out to be the game-winning hit, the game-winning run in the series. The whole thing is a terrific metaphor for the Tampa Bay Rays and the New York Yankees. The Rays have the 28th out of 30. They have the 28th largest payroll in baseball this year. The Yankees, of course, have the most expensive payroll in baseball. The Rays had the best record in the American League all year long. Shortened season, sure. They just took down the Yankees in the playoffs with an undrafted guy hitting the game-winning run. The Rays now move on to play the team with the fourth largest payroll in baseball, the Houston Astros. If they win that series, they will likely face the Los Angeles Dodgers, who have the second largest payroll in baseball in the World Series. This is a terrific underdog story, a terrific story of guys like Mike Broussard earning their way to the top of the table in baseball, even though they don't have any right to be there, or they, you know, people don't necessarily value them the same way as they value guys like Aroldis Chapman. Most people listening to this podcast are probably already rolling their eyes and don't care about the sports ball. But if at some point in the next 2 weeks you hear about the Tampa Bay Rays going to the World Series or winning the World Series, I hope you will like give a little cheer for this crazy underdog story in what has just been a wacky season anyway, marred by the coronavirus and all of that. So I'm fully 100% on the Tampa Bay Rays bandwagon right there.
Catherine, what COVID sports have you been watching? Are you going to give us some payroll data here?
The only real COVID sport is doom scrolling, and that's what I've been doing. So I want to recommend to y'all the Instagram and other social media host, the account of Humans of New York. This is a classic. It's been around for a long time, but in particular, the story of Tangeray. Tangeray is a woman whose real name is Stephanie. And there was a 32-part series from Humans of New York, which was her story. She was a burlesque dancer and stripper in New York. Her life story is absolutely wild. She's now in her late 70s, and it is a journey, and she has receipts. And what's striking to me about this story is that she is like a classic example of a person who's entire life was lived in gray and black markets. She just simply was not part of the mainstream economy of this country at all. As a result, or partially,
she was the Jerry Tuchilli of her time.
She was the Jerry Tuchilli of her time, except for a black stripper. So she is actually was in pretty dire financial straits at the time that she's telling this story to Brandon, who is the impresario of Humans of New York, and he often does fundraisers for the people that he features. And this fundraiser raised $2.65 million for this woman. Just an incredible example, not only of charity and generosity and kindness, but also, you know, this is the kind of story that occurs to me when people say the right thing to do is for government to take care of people. And this is a woman who was screwed over by the government repeatedly, both because of her professional choices and in her early life, she actually did time in prison, who was not part of the Social Security system, who was not involved in any of the government healthcare schemes, and who was helped entirely outside of that system, who has been the recipient now of like a massive amount of private charity, so much so that she has already committed to donating the rest of whatever is left from the charitable donations to her, to another charity. Just like a wildly cool story that became a wildly inspiring story. I highly recommend that you go check it out. You can see it at the Humans of New York website. You can see it if you just sign up for their Instagram feed, Tangeray.
Nick, tell us an inspiring story of someone living off the grid.
I wish I could, but instead I watched Saturday Night Live over the weekend, and Bill Burr, the stand-up comedian and participant in F is for Family on Netflix, gave a particularly rancid monologue for a particularly forgettable episode, and where he, among other things, said that Black Lives Matter had been completely hijacked by white women, like upper-class white women. Then went on to talk about how Black History Month is the shortest month and that that's an outrage. It was one of the, and the reason I bring it up is not simply because it was so bad, but it was emblematic of a long-term decline in Saturday Night Live and kind of mainstream broadcast culture, I think, where, you know, some of us are old enough to remember Saturday Night Live as edgy and interesting. And this is kind of like one of the worst kind of moments where you just have a stand-up who's not particularly good, who's best known for being on Joe Rogan, who would have been an interest, who would be a very interesting host to see somebody who is cutting edge on a different new medium, intersecting with something which is now an institution on NBC, be interesting. And instead, you just get a kind of lame performance that is politically correct in the worst way possible. Of course, throws women under, white women in particular, who are now, we all recognize, are the true source of all evil in the world, under the bus.
True.
You know, and it's just, it so that's what I've been cogitating on over the past week.
I have been watching a show that I think is actually edgy and interesting and borders on not being politically correct, in, at least in certain ways, if only because it is so utterly, utterly bonkers. I'm talking about Raised by Wolves, which is which just finished its 10 episode first season on HBO Max. The first couple of episodes were directed by Ridley Scott, you know, a kind of institution in the world of feature filmmaking, the guy who directed Alien and Blade Runner and Gladiator and a whole bunch of other movies. This is his first foray into television. I mean, the guy's in his 70s and he's still incredibly productive. It's kind of amazing. And it develops on a lot of the themes that and ideas that Scott has been working with for years. It's a story about survival in a sort of wasteland planet far in the future. Earth has been more or less destroyed by a war between a religious faction that is quite high tech and an atheist faction that has, in some cases, stolen or repurposed the technology of the religious faction. And in particular here, a part of the atheist faction has repurposed two androids that were originally built by the religious faction and sent them off to this other planet that is sort of a wasteland far, far away to raise a bunch of children. And then, of course, a big colony ship with religious settlers ends up at the planet. Conflict ensues. But the show gets so much weirder than that, especially in the last couple of episodes where, without going too far into spoilers, it is definitely the first series I've seen in ever that culminates in a flying alien half robot snake god being birthed. And man, it's actually kind of great. It just doesn't feel like it's in any way constrained by the normal rules of television or, you know, expectations or decorum. It's really interesting about religion and about society and about sort of how difficult it is for authority figures to control the beliefs of the people that they are supposedly overseeing. It's just kind of fascinating and complicated. It's probably not for everyone. It's definitely not a show with a whole lot of very ordinary or relatable human psychology, but it is visually interesting and just really, really neat on an ideas level and does a bunch of stuff that you don't typically see in television. So for like in some ways, it actually reminds me of like an undiscovered late 1980s, early 1990s BBC sci-fi show, except instead of being produced, you know, for pocket change, it's got a gigantic Ridley Scott size budget. So for folks who like that kind of thing, I highly recommend it. It's on HBO Max. And with that, we are done for this week. Thank you all for listening. Please remember to tune in next week and to subscribe to all of our podcasts, including Nick Gillespie's excellent interview show, which will be going on again this week. Thank you again. We will be back next week with Matt Welch, who will have perfected his sourdough.